Hello and welcome to Canary Pod, a podcast from the team behind the Canary. I'm Kerri-Anne Mendoza, the Canary's co-founder and editor-in-chief. Each week we bring you a look behind the scenes at the biggest stories of the last 7 days. Today, it's the moral test of government. Speaking on November the 1st, 1977, former US Vice President Hubert Humphrey said, "The moral test of government is how the government treats those who are in the dawn of life, the children, those who are in the twilight of life, the elderly, those who are in the shadows of life, the sick, the needy, and the disabled." A few stories from the last week show how the UK and other governments are currently failing that moral test. Our conversation will take us through England and Wales, Scotland and Iceland. I'll be joined by UK editor Beck Sumner and journalists Steve Topple and James Wright. Welcome, team.
Hello.
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 Let's start with Bex. Bex, you're here to talk about how children with special educational needs have been let down by the government. Can you start by explaining what special educational needs are and then look at the events that Sean Williams reported for the Canary this week?
Right, this is a quiet scandal, really, that's been affecting thousands of children with special educational needs. Special educational needs basically mean it covers a whole range of conditions or situations where children might have problems with their schoolwork, communication or behaviour issues. It would include children with autism, for example. It's children who need extra pastoral care, extra support, extra advice to kind of have a successful and happy and thriving school life.
Got it.
What's happened is that thousands of children with special educational needs were left in limbo by their local authorities. They basically didn't know which secondary school they would be going to, or, you know, whether they'd be going to one. Each child with special educational needs is meant to have an educational health care statement,
okay,
which helps them to move from primary school to secondary. So it's a big moment for these kids. It's a big moment for any child to move from primary to secondary school. It can be stressful. It can be frightening. But these 2,400 children were left without that statement, which meant they couldn't have their secondary school confirmed, which meant that many have faced a summer of absolute stress of not knowing which school they're going to, what support they'll get when they get there, or whether they don't have the chance to appeal any decisions that have been made about their schooling because local authorities have failed to deliver their statements on time.
Well, and I mean, that's no small thing. I think probably most people listening will be able to remember that summer between primary school and secondary school and actually how nerve-wracking it was waiting for the little brown envelope, you know, with your letter in it to guarantee your school. And these kids aren't only wondering which school they're going to go to, they're wondering if they're going to get to go at all, right?
Yeah, I think a few of them might be in that position. And what kind of you know, support they'll have when they get there. And the schools are complaining as well, because they said, you know, the secondary school, our writer Sean Williams spoke to a head teacher who came forward and said, we don't know which pupils are turning up in September. We can't plan for what we need to do to support them when they get here. So yeah, it's having a massive knock-on effect on children. You know, a lot of children with special educational needs kind of really rely on routine and certainty, and you know, there's parents that are reporting massive anxiety. The yeah. solicitor who exposed this with Freedom of Information request said that some of the children are going through such stress that it's having real physical, you know, it's doing them real physical harm.
This is outrageous.
Yeah, Sean, the writer, spoke to a couple of parents. You know, one of them was saying he's been visiting the school that they were hoping he would go to a few times, so he gets used to it, so he gets to see familiar faces and stuff. He has autism, and now he's extremely anxious through no fault of his own. He's been totally let down by the state. So yeah, pretty devastating stuff.
And I have to say, some pretty brilliant journalism by Sean Williams as well. We'll put a link to this story in the notes for the podcast, so do check it out and read the full story. It's really harrowing. And the only thing I'd finish on, Bex, is you've touched there on the on this issue being uncovered by Freedom of Information request. So what happened there? Are we saying that the government hasn't come forward and announced and said, you know, we're behind the curve on this important issue and we'd like to apologize and this is what we're doing about it? Has this actually something that has been uncovered rather than admitted to?
It's down to local authorities technically, because it's a statutory requirement that they have to meet this deadline. I guess it's taken freedom of information requests to get that information from all the local education authorities. But, central government, Theresa May bears a lot of responsibility on this too, because there's been drastic cuts in funding to local authorities, which is putting pressure on schools, on teachers. Mm. It's no exaggeration at all to say schools are in total crisis. You know, that's what teachers and pupils across the country are saying. Staffing levels, class sizes, cuts to mental health services. Like, head teachers are writing begging letters to parents just to meet basic needs of their children.
Yeah.
It's 9 in 10 school leaders believe that budget cuts have had a detrimental effect on the education of pupils with special educational needs.
Wow.
It's just not on.
So, it's in a very similar story to what we've seen across the NHS, isn't it? This is where you've got actually an effective public service, one of the most effective public services in the world, literally being kind of run into the ground by an ideological austerity government.
Exactly. And it's not like you can cut the funding and then later a future government can just come and turn the taps back on and everything will be fine. You know, we're losing skills. We're losing, there's children that are only going through the educational system once in their life.
Yeah.
So it's their future. If it's trashed, it's trashed.
That's actually a really, really good point you make, actually. I think for a lot of people, we believe that ultimately the service will survive because we won't have Tories forever. Eventually, we'll get rid of them and move into something better. But as you say, that's going to mean nothing to the kids right now who are having to survive this educational system where they're supersized classes and teachers who are knackered, overworked and under-resourced. Terrible state of it. Thank you so much, Bex, for leading us through that. And as I've said, listeners, you can go and read that full story, and I urge you to. It's linked to the notes of the podcast. So next, we're going to Steve Topple. I actually picked two of your stories to talk about this week, Steve, because I literally couldn't choose between the two of them. One is a UK story, one is from Iceland, but both actually tell a story about how we respond as a society to perceived weakness. Steve, let's start with Scotland, and then we'll travel across to Iceland from there.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, both of these stories kind of feed into the overview you presented at the start, Kerri-Anne, which is one of the moral failings of government, of those on the fringes and those who are most vulnerable in society.
Yeah.
So the first story from Scotland was the National Records Office in Scotland released its latest drug-related death statistics for 2016. The fundamentals of the story were that Scotland has seen a huge spike in the number of drug-related deaths. Just going through some of the facts and figures, in 2016, the country registered 867 drug-related deaths. It's the largest number ever recorded and 23% higher than in 2015. And to put it into some sort of context, go back to 2006 and that figure has now doubled. 327 deaths, the largest majority were in people aged 35 to 44. And interestingly, men accounted for 68% of all deaths, which again is quite a staggering figure when you compare it to the figures for England and Wales. But there was a more broader picture here as well, if you like. The deaths related to opiates or opioids, that is heroin, morphine or methadone, made up 88% of the total deaths. They either were directly involved or they contributed to the deaths. So there's a real problem with opiates and opioids now in Scotland as well. Feeding into this, what this story kind of showed, if you like, it was a microcosm of the bigger picture across the UK, because reports came out at the end of last year and the start of this year that the UK has turned into, if you like, the drug death capital of Europe. For example, overall drug-related deaths in the UK has risen by 67%, and heroin-related deaths by 107% since 2012. And now what we're seeing, the reason the UK has this this tag of the drug-related death capital of the UK is that almost a third of drug overdoses in Europe happened in the UK. I mean, that's out of 28 countries. Yeah. Out of 28 countries in the EU, a third of all drug overdoses are happening in the UK. And Britain also has the highest proportion of heroin addicts in the EU. That's 18 every 1,000 people. And what else? Drug mortality rate, that's also three times the EU average. There's 60.3 deaths per million people that's related to drugs. So, I mean, the figures are just, they're quite unbelievable. They kind of feed into something else I report on a lot, which is the alcohol related deaths and alcohol related illness figures as well, because again the UK has a severe problem with that, much higher than the rest of Europe. So there is this constant issue bubbling of addiction and substance misuse in the UK, and the Scotland figures really put that into sharp perspective, if you like.
And I mean, this isn't even occurring as even vaguely an issue in any in any political scenario at the moment, is it? I'm not hearing many, I know, I'm certainly not hearing party leaders talking about this. It's not featuring on in the news really as an issue. And yet it's endemic. So, Steve, what are some of, like, obviously this seems to be a crisis which is worsening and deepening, but why is Britain in this situation? Why is Scotland in this situation? What are the factors that are driving people into addiction?
Okay, so I mean, there are numerous theories surrounding this. Some are quite mainstream. Some are more, if you like, left field. I mean, the mainstream consensus coming out from particularly opposition parties, especially Labour and the SNP, is that this war on drugs that's right. not only the UK but the US has been operating since after the Second World War, if you like, is clearly failing. There is still, despite numerous governments' reforms surrounding drug policy, the consensus is that drug policy is still very a criminal justice led one, where it should be a health led drug policy. There was an SNP MP called Ronnie Cowan who came out after Scotland's drug statistics were published. Bear in mind as well, Scotland drug policy is generally devolved in Scotland, so the SNP are responsible for the drug policy there. And he says that while the Scottish government is undergoing its own review of drugs policy, the UK government is not on board with the fact that drug addiction needs to be treated as a health issue and not a criminal justice one. And again, we're seeing this, especially in America and other European countries, that there is this distinction that's not being made between the criminal justice aspects, i.e. punishing people for taking drugs, and the health issue. But I've written about this a lot as well. There are more left-field views out there with regards to addiction and the society we live in. There's specifically a psychologist called Dr. Gabor Maté, a Hungarian-Canadian psychologist.
Yeah, well, he's brilliant. He's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, he's super,
really like his work on addiction.
Yeah, amazing guy. And he directly links corporatist capitalism, if you like, to the addiction that is pervading society at the minute. He says that addiction is a response, if you like, to the way society has been leading. There was a brilliant quote that he put in one of his books called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, and he said that a sense of deficient emptiness pervades our entire culture, and that the drug addict is more painfully conscious of his void than most people, but has limited means of escaping it. I mean, essentially that people who are addicts, whether it be alcohol, drugs, are more perceptive to all the wrongs in society, and the only way they can deal with it is by getting so annihilated and blotting it all out so that they don't have to face it anymore. But there's several journalists as well who've taken this another step, if you like, even on top of what Gabor Maté says. Naomi Klein has addressed this issue. She says it's not only a response to corporatist society, but a society that now systematically severs connections from each other and from our natural surroundings. And she says, because we're becoming quite isolated in terms of physical interactions, that effect on our psychology and it increases the likelihood of addiction. And another journalist, Johan Harry, is a British journalist. He takes it even further than that. He says that all addictions, such as addictions to sugar, people's addictions to shopping, addictions to pornography, the internet, these are all reactions to the scourge, if you like, of corporatist capitalism that we're seeing now. And it's a human response to the breakdown of society, if you like, as we know it, and the individualism and isolationalism that exists in our world now, and addiction is a response to that.
It really is fascinating. I think What's interesting for me as well, Steve, is that whether you're sort of in the sort of Gabor Maté, Naomi Klein camp of pinning this on, you know, as you would put it, corporatist capitalism, or you're, you know, a mental health professional or an addiction specialist, there's actually a there is actually a lot of common ground, even though they present superficially as sort of different camps. Actually, there's a lot of common ground, because essentially both are saying that the issue here is that we're actually not dealing with the symptom, like we're dealing with the symptoms and not the cause of this crisis, and that we're basically saying, you know, similarly to homelessness, actually, you know, is that we're not actually saying we have a problem that people are too poor to live in shelter, or we have a problem that people are suffering living with addiction. We're actually saying the problem is, oh, the streets are covered in needles. The problem is, oh, I tried to go, you know, to the shop the other day and I had to step over a prisoner's sleeping bag. Like that, like the problem is the inconvenience, you know, caused by someone else's suffering, not the suffering itself.
Absolutely. I mean, it's an analogy I like to use a lot, but essentially what governments and a lot of health professionals and third sector organisations are doing is just putting a sticking plaster on a broken leg. Yeah. And the thing is also where there's common denominators that stand out, especially between what the likes of Klein, Maté and Harry are saying and what professionals are saying, is that all these issues of addiction have one common denominator, which is they affect the poorest in society the greatest. You see it in alcohol statistics. Rates of, for example, A&E admissions due to alcohol poisoning were 3.5 times higher among those in the 20% most deprived areas of England than they were in the least deprived areas. Wow. 24% of all alcohol-related deaths are in the poorest category of socioeconomic statuses. Look at obesity, for example. Rates of childhood obesity in the 10% most deprived areas of the country are twice as likely to be higher than the 10% least deprived. And smoking as well. 30% of adult smokers are in the poorest socioeconomic statuses. And you see the same figures with drug use. All these addictions, whether you agree with it or not, linked to corporatism and capitalism, but they all share the same common denominator, that addiction disproportionately affects the poorest people in the society most. And that is what we need to be addressing, why this has happened to the poorest people, not just dealing with the end result of people's addictions in the first place. This is where governments are missing the trip.
So are there any moves at the moment, Steve, to do something about this situation? Like what is happening to alleviate this?
Everything. Where do you want me to start? We've got another hour for this.
if you could just sort of keep it brief.
No, I know. Look, essentially, the current Conservative government is doing nothing. They have reformed their drug policy after their own internal report into their previous drug policy said it wasn't working. There was a big debate in the House of Commons a few weeks ago, which I reported on, where, for example, the minister in charge of drug policy did not recognise alcohol as a drug.
I remember this.
Recognised there was a problem with it. I mean, your mind just is blown by the attitude of these people. And I can't see that any current government we have, and I hate to say it, I don't think Labour quite has the right handle on this either. We need, until we see a shift in the train of thought of politicians with how they approach addiction, then all we're going to continue to do is dealing with the symptoms and not the problems. I can't personally see, and speaking as an addict myself, I can't see any positive manoeuvres on the horizon regarding this. And I think with forecasts, especially looking at like the economic situation in this country, I think things are only going to get worse before they get better.
And is there any model anywhere in the world that's maybe had some form of success that we could be learning from?
It's interesting you say that. Okay, so look at Portugal, for example, where they have decriminalised to a certain extent the use of heroin. Yeah. They have reduced the prevalence of heroin addiction. They have supervised programmes. They have centres where people can go and inject. And that has reduced the rates slightly of addiction, but it's dramatically reduced the rate of deaths relating to addiction. There are markers of countries that are doing certain things, but again, nothing is overall working perfectly, if you like.
So basically, this is a question for all of us, isn't it? It's that this is a question that we're not even asking, let alone answering at the moment very effectively.
Essentially, it's a question which underpins everything we ask and everything we discuss relating politics more broadly. What kind of society and financial system and system of governance do we want to be living in? It's that same question which underpins everything.
Brilliant. Thank you, Steve.
Hi, I'm Nancy Mendoza, Director of Communications and Membership at The Canary. Are you a Canary member? If you are, you've got some branded merchandise. We'd love to see what you're doing with it. So please do take a picture of yourself with your mug or your pen or wearing your t-shirt and share it on Twitter with hashtag CanaryPod. We'll look for the best, the funniest, the most inspiring picture, and that person will receive a little extra bit of merchandise from us as a gift and a thank you, and we'll announce the winner on next week's podcast. If you're not a Canary member yet, you can join at www.thecanary.co/membership. There's a few different options for monthly membership with benefits associated with each, and it's the best way really to support free independent journalism at The Canary, Britain's leading independent news website. Thanks.
And now we have the Iceland story, and I've got to say, Steve, it's, you know, when we're pitching stories in the newsroom, because we're all writing about numerous issues, you know, it's often something that you've thought about, you've considered. It's not very often that my jaw literally drops when someone pitches a story, Steve. But when I was going through your pitch for this Iceland story this week, genuinely my mouth was hanging open. I've not been that shocked by something in some considerable time. So, Steve, what's happened?
Okay. So the US network CBS released a documentary this week on Iceland. It was specifically relating to abortion and specifically relating to the termination of babies that had been screened and were thought to have Down syndrome. Now, what was interesting about the story is the way that CBS framed it. CBS framed it in terms of the fact that Iceland were coming close to eradicating, their words not mine, eradicating Down syndrome from society. The underlying reasons for this were because the government has a policy of informing all expectant mothers about certain tests that are available, chromosome tests, which can show fairly positively, they're not 100% accurate, but fairly positively, whether a baby is carrying the chromosomes, the genetic makeup that will lead to that child having Down syndrome. So women are informed of this test. 80 to 85% of these women will go on to have this test. And then consequently, nearly 100% of women whose unborn children are expected to have Down syndrome choose to have an abortion.
Okay, Nancy just wanted to come in with something.
I think I'm right in saying, Steve, you probably know definitively that in the UK, the time limit for abortion is 24 weeks of pregnancy.
Yeah.
But if the abortion is happening because of a diagnosis of Down syndrome, there effectively is no limit.
Yes, correct. And that is the same. It's the same situation in Iceland. It's exactly the same thing. So again,
Just to take that in for a minute.
Yeah.
That means that a woman who is pregnant with a child who has Down syndrome can effectively terminate that pregnancy at full term.
Yeah. I think well done for raising that, because that kind of encapsulates the whole story, if you like, because it is the same in Iceland. Iceland's abortion limit is usually 16 weeks, which is a lot lower than us. But they have that same policy. And that just sums it up, because you are then going from, which is one of the arguments, I suppose, for pro-choice or pro-life, you're going from what is essentially a fetus right up to what is, in no uncertain terms, a human being. It was interesting, there was one briefly, CBS quoted one of the counsellors who deals with women who have abortions regarding Down syndrome. And she told reporters, she said, "We don't look at abortion as murder. We look at it as a thing that we ended. We ended a possible life that may have had a huge complication, preventing suffering for the child and for the family." I mean, it's just the language involved with a person who's potentially going to be living with Down syndrome, that it's a complication and it's suffering. I worked for quite a while as a key worker for people with Down syndrome. Their life is not full of suffering and complications. The people with living with Down syndrome can live a fuller life as the rest of us, provided, and this is the caveat, provided they have the right bloody support and the right people around them, then their lives can be as fulfilling and as diverse and as enriched as anyone else. It's not a complication that by aborting a fetus or a child is preventing suffering. I mean, this is a load of bullshit I've heard in my entire life. But obviously it makes me furious, absolutely furious, that language like this can be just chucked around and accepted in the way that this was in the CBS article, because it's absolute bullshit, it's nonsense, and essentially, but like you say, that abortion statistic and the methodology and the thinking behind that is the underpinning, and that is the crux of the story, Nancy, yes, that it's somehow different for a child that may be born with Down syndrome.
And, you know, as you say, the lives of people with Down syndrome now are very, very different than they were even, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. When, you know, 20 years ago, life expectancy for someone with Down syndrome was sort of early 30s. And actually many, many people with Down syndrome are living into their 60s and 70s. And that's because of better physical health care. So that, you know, they can tend to have heart problems, which are now being treated very effectively. But there's also a huge problem of people with Down syndrome going into old age are very, very prone to Alzheimer's. And there is woefully little research going on. There is some, but woefully little research going on to understand, you know, what it is about having three chromosome number 21s that makes them susceptible to Alzheimer's, which could potentially unlock some of the secrets of Alzheimer's for everybody else who gets Alzheimer's. And these are people who are their children, their siblings, their parents, they work, you know. I'm quite interested in you know, disability issues myself, and recently seen a couple of fantastic documentaries, one about a young woman in South America who has Down syndrome, who is actually a nursery school teacher. She takes class on her own of some small children, and she teaches them, and she, you know, engages them in play and all of those things, just as any other nursery teacher would. Also a man who's now in his 40s, who was the first person with an intellectual disability to be awarded something called the J.P. Kennedy Fellowship, which is an opportunity for somebody with a disability to do a 12-month public policy placement on Capitol Hill. So this guy, you know, he must be sort of mid-late 40s now, and he's spent a year advising, you know, the most senior politicians, right up to the 11th president, on public policy for people with disabilities. Now, if that's not contributing, then, you know, I don't know what is. But, you know, not everybody with Down syndrome has the opportunity to do that kind of thing or the ability, but every single person is important to their family, is important to their friends, is important to their colleagues, you know, is important to the people who they encounter every day. And, you know, the idea that, you know, this is being done with a view that people with Down syndrome, you know, don't contribute, don't have a quality of life, it's just absolutely disgusting to me.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There was a key phrase in there, and said that not everyone with Down syndrome has the ability to do what the man in America did, which is correctly true. The point is, every person with Down syndrome should have the bloody opportunity to see if they do have that ability.
Exactly.
Now, obviously, this story was staggering, partly because of the way CBS framed it, because the article itself and the report was quite fair and balanced. They gave opinion from people who were pro abortion and pro the abortion of Down syndrome children, and also people who were against it. However, the wording of the article, it was quite, they presented it in a really casual way, if you like, which I knew drew a lot of criticism on Twitter.
That was the thing for me, was the headline of the CBS story, it just absolutely took my breath away. I mean, it said something like, Iceland on pace to eliminate Down syndrome through abortion, as if abortion was a cure for a disease called Down syndrome. It was like Africa eliminates malaria through for a vaccine. It was just like, it was so absolutely cold and so intentional. And, you know, for something which I think is almost circumstantial, you know, I don't think, you know, I think that, you know, I'm absolutely pro-choice. But in being pro-choice, I accept that I don't get to agree or disagree with the choice a woman makes, if that makes sense. So once you say you're pro-choice, you go, oh, I'm pro-choice, accept that choice. And in this case, you have a situation where each woman has individually made a choice and each family has individually made a choice for whatever reason that they're not going to proceed with this pregnancy in the case of Down syndrome. And that has led to a social result. And I can only imagine being an Icelandic woman who's terminated a pregnancy because of Down syndrome, effectively being called a eugenicist, by the American press. I find it breathtaking.
It was staggering, and this was the challenge, not only when writing about this, but also when trying to sort of get my bloody head around it, if you like, because firstly, I'm extremely pro-choice. It's a woman's body. It's ultimately a woman's child, and they should have the final say in what they do with their bodies and what they do with their children. There's no question of that, if you like. But the challenge of the story was that the American right, especially the likes of Ted Cruz and Sarah Palin, jumped on this and were damning Iceland, damning the system. But I don't believe they were damning it from a viewpoint of the sort of implications for disabled people and people living with Down syndrome. They were damning it from a viewpoint of a fundamentalist Christian right-wing view that abortion is wrong generally. And that was the first challenge with the story. But also, when you cut through CBS's article and when you actually take a step back and look at this, what Iceland is doing is not actually dissimilar to any other country. When you look at the facts and figures, the UK has a Down syndrome abortion rate of 90%. Denmark has a Down syndrome abortion rate of 98%.
Wow.
So this was the thing with the story. There was uproar because of the way CBS presented it, and they presented it that abortion was a cure to Down syndrome. Iceland has not found a cure. It was the framing of the article which caused controversy, but the underlying situation and the underlying thrust of what is happening across the globe is that governments and institutions of governments seem to be actively encouraging people to terminate babies who are suspected of having Down syndrome. And that is the broader point here. And again, the broader question we need to be asking ourselves as society, because the situation in Iceland, in the UK, in Denmark, again, feeds into, you, if you like, this growing notion of anyone who's sick or disabled or has a genetic condition as somehow being lesser than everyone else in society. I mean, it was summed up, and I know, I bang on about this all the time. I seem to reference it in about 5 articles a week. But the UN released a report last year into disabled people's rights in the UK, and it said that successive Conservative-led governments have committed grave and systematic violations of disabled people's human rights. Now, I want to be specific here. The definition of systematic is when something is done or acting according to a fixed plan or system. That is, it is methodical. That's the dictionary definition of systematic. And so what the UN was saying, because the UN don't use words unless they mean it, that Conservative governments were methodically violating disabled people's human rights. And this Down syndrome story and the statistics from the UK and from Iceland and from other countries feeds into what is happening across the globe, where disabled people are being marginalized, they're having their rights eroded, they're seen as lesser than the rest of us in society. The UN specifically said in this report, for example, that successive governments had helped to create a, quote, public perception where disabled people have been negatively portrayed as being dependent or making a living out of benefits, being lazy and putting a burden on the taxpayers who are paying money for nothing. Not my words, the UN's words.
Yeah.
That's the underlying issue with this story. It is the negative and systematic degradation of disabled people's rights across the world. We saw it with refugee statistics this week. 10 million of the 65 million people who were forcibly displaced in 2016 were disabled. And it's a societal problem. And it refers back to what we're talking about when we discuss addiction. It's a question of how we wish to be governed, what sort of society we wish to live in that underpins this. And it's the same damn question which underpins everything we talk about at the Canary, in my opinion, on every day of the week.
It really does. And as you say, it's again, what lessons can you take from this situation that apply at large?
Yeah.
And I think you've done a really good job of going through those. I think for me as well, the other question it raised was back to that, you know, the social versus the medical model of disability. Mm. You know, in one, it's just like people are differently abled. You know, I can hear right wingers everywhere now just screaming. But literally, you know, people are just simply different from each other.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And our society, our urban spaces, our rural spaces, our public spaces all need to accommodate for all people. Because and then you have the medical model, which says, no, there's a right version of being a person and a wrong version of being a person. And so if you know, if you're missing your sight or your hearing, or you know, you move differently or more slowly than other people, then you're disabled.
Absolutely. I mean, for anyone who doesn't understand, the social model of disability in the most basic of terms is that it is not a person's health that makes them disabled. It's the society that makes them disabled. And that is at the crux of all of this. And I mean, the social model of disability has not really ever been adopted by governments anyway. The Labour Party only came out this year and said that it's basing its policy on the social model. And we seem to think, in my opinion, that especially in the UK, that as a society and as a species, we've come leaps and bounds when it comes to disabled people's rights. We've been forward thinking and that we're modern that we're somehow progressive when it comes to disabled people's rights. And I'm sorry, but we're actually not. I mean, we made progress under the Blair government, but as I say, even they didn't adopt the social model of disability.
Yeah.
And now we've just gone back decades and decades and decades. And it's another one of these issues which I can't see improving anytime soon. It's another constant battle, if you like, for one of the most basic things in society, which is a person's human rights and a right to live independent lives in the way you want to live them.
Absolutely. I mean, I can remember a few years ago when I was writing the Script Tonight daily blog, and I'd written a piece on, you know, the exclusion of a whole bunch of people from public life, essentially, because we don't build our urban spaces to accommodate different people. And it had been partially triggered by, I had labyrinthitis, so I lost the ability to walk for about sort of 8-9 months.
Okay,
and actually experiencing, you know, spaces that were completely familiar to me, you know, just literally getting to the doctors, which was, you know, had been a 5-minute walk, and was suddenly a 20-minute, half-an-hour struggle, and kind of how differently I felt in these spaces, and realising, you know, literally things like, if there aren't lines on the edges of steps, you know, I didn't really have any depth perception. So I was relying on those little, you know, coloured ridges on the edge of steps to let me know where the edge of the step was. Otherwise, to me, it occurred as a ramp.
Yeah.
You know, and it's these little things which I'd kind of had in my mind, and I'll be completely honest, it's kind of like, oh, you know, health and safety, you know, kind of blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly you're presented with the world in a completely different way. It seemed very exclusionary. So I'd written this piece on it, And someone put up sort of a contrary opinion on social media with an image of saying no blacks, no dogs, no Irish, and saying, oh, yeah, but, you know, this isn't happening to disabled people. And I just responded with a no disabled access sign. It's like, what do you think that is?
Exactly.
It's the same thing.
It was interesting. I was outside the Royal Courts of Justice yesterday reporting on a court case, which I wrote about. And I was chatting to a lawyer there, and we both said the same thing, that I don't think we as a society actually understand or appreciate or take disabled people's rights that seriously. We all sort of make noises off.
Yeah.
And we all give lip service to disability, if you like. But I don't think most people truly understand it. I don't think they truly appreciate just what disabled people have to go through to get in line with the rest of us, and how many barriers there are in the world to living in a way which we all take for granted. I don't think there's an appreciation there. And I think there's even less of a bloody appreciation from politicians across the board as well. I have very little respect for any of them, I'm afraid, regarding disability. But it's a societal issue and a societal challenge, and it's a conversation that we need to be having.
I think that's what's so dangerous about this whole topic, is again, it's like, it does move us into the eugenics arena, which I don't think anyone particularly wants to be in. And it's sort of like a capitalist version of eugenics, isn't it? It's about kind of weeding out. I mean, we're talking about the whole point of this podcast is the moral test of government being how, you know, we treat our vulnerable, or in fact, just different. And I think this is about people in general being schooled to judge people's value in terms of pounds, shilling and pence, you know, in terms of their ability to contribute to the capitalist system, not their inherent value, you know, as a person, you know.
Absolutely.
As Nancy said, as a son, a daughter, a parent, a friend, just a person, you know. It's like we have to find ways of saying no, but maybe let them live because they might be able to make some money for some people. It seems completely ass about face to me, as our sort of whole value system is predicated on the capitalist model and not the human model, or just the...
That is exactly what underpins this story. Is exactly what underpins the story about addiction, and it's what underpins Shan's story about children with special educational needs not getting places. That essentially we are groomed from a young age right into adulthood to conform to being a person which is essentially there to contribute to the gross domestic product of a country, and those who cannot contribute to a country's GDP are considered lesser and not gifted with the opportunities from the state and from society that everyone else does. You're on a mass conveyor belt of being a robotic money-making object, and if you're not on the conveyor belt, you get chucked off into the spare parts bin.
Steve, thank you so much for writing that story this week and for coming on the podcast to speak about it. We've spent a while on that story, and I think we should, because there are so many. I almost feel like we could have a podcast dedicated just to this story, because I think it's a really... Absolutely. It is a huge question. So thanks for that, Steve.
Okay.
You may well be sitting there infuriated by this point, and you're right to be furious. If you're not outraged right now, you probably aren't paying attention. But anger is only really useful as a catalyst. And as one of my mentors used to tell me, lingering in hatred is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. So at the Canary, we feel like it's far better to get involved. And James Wright has a great story, which is going to give everyone listening at home a chance to turn their upset into some positive action. So James, wagwan.
So... right now, what's going on is something called the Unseat campaign.
Yep.
And this campaign is a specific campaign about high-profile Conservative MPs.
I mean, this is really exciting. So people at home, essentially what you're looking at is you've got eight of the worst, like basically like the eight core baddies, if you want, in this kind of cast. Yeah, this cast of Conservatives. Who are they again? We've got, can you go through all eight?
Yeah, so I was just looking at your article and the list is Justine Greening, Amber Rudd, Anna Soubry, Boris Johnson, Ian Duncan Smith, Philip Davies, Grant Shapps and Stephen Crabb.
So basically, the worst Tories. They're all bad in their own individual ways.
And they have marginal seats, which means in their next election, we can specifically target these seats and get them gone.
In the mainstream media, there hasn't actually been much exploration of this since the election. Mm-hmm. I can't help but think that if it was the other way around with Labour and Conservatives, there would have been much more talk of how many high-profile Conservative majorities have been slashed to almost nothing.
Yeah.
Amber Rudd's is hanging on by, I think, 364 votes.
Yep.
And she's the Home Secretary, and they haven't replaced her. So that's the Home Secretary going down, probably, if we can continue the momentum from the last election. But it's not just that this unseat campaign is the only campaign going on right now. Jeremy Corbyn is on a permanent election footing and he's going around all other marginals. But this campaign is something that many people can get involved in because it involves such high profile MPs like Boris Johnson, like Ian Duncan Smith, like Philip Davies. Some of the most hated people in the country are now hanging on by a thread. Boris Johnson's campaign was halved. His majority was halved. Yeah, in the last election, from about 10,000 to 5,000 votes. So really, there has been just a massive influx of marginal seats that hasn't really been discussed that much. But it's why so many people who are involved in just the campaign for change are really excited, because it's not just the election result that delivered a historic swing in the polls, historic swing in vote share, but it's that it's teed up a victory because of how many marginal seats there are now.
It's really easy, I think, when you get kind of so angry, so frustrated, it feels like these people are going to be there forever. I know people, you know, it's kind of similar to how people felt in the 80s with the Thatcher government and the Conservatives then, of just like, we're stuck with these people for life. But as you say, James, the reality is, you know, people like Amber Rudd are only there because of 300 and something votes. You know, that would be a close...
After a load of recounts as well.
I know, right? And I mean, that would be a close result.
At least two, I think.
Oh my God, I didn't realise it was two. I knew it was one. That would be a close result in like a parish council election, you know, let alone a constituency for parliament.
And so, Justin Greening's majority, the education secretary, was slashed by 85%. Amber Rudd's was 93% slashed. You know, that's a huge gains in these constituencies.
So, I mean, what you can say is essentially most of the hard work has been done. Because in the last election, a lot of these constituencies have gone from safe seats, you know, or at least healthy majority seats, to seriously marginal seats that are now vulnerable. And yeah. Owen Jones and a cast of kind of other figures of the left are basically travelling around the country to these eight constituencies, right?
Mm.
And what are they up to? Do you know?
Well, they've already held just campaign rallies in Amber Rudd's seat was first, I think.
And Hastings?
Then, yeah, in Hastings, and Boris Johnson's in Uxbridge.
Mm-hmm.
They've already held campaign events there earlier in the year. And they are essentially trying to get people excited about the fact that we can really get rid of these people, and they are traveling to these constituencies and rallying local activists. I know behind the scenes as well, Momentum is training activists not only to campaign out and about, but also to create digital viral content
super
and stuff like that, stuff that hello, Labour HQ, what are you spending the membership money on? I don't know.
Because, it's a very good point you make.
Because they're not doing anything, basically. The election was pretty much won without Labour, as in the Labour machine. It was won by Corbyn's own campaign in his office and the Momentum Grassroots campaign.
I mean,
they basically said, you guys own this, and then when you fail, you guys can take over responsibility, and then the opposite happens.
It's actually, I found that particularly funny, given that I can remember last year's Labour Party conference, I'd snuck into an event that the Fabians were holding at the Fringe. So you had like guys like John McTurnan, you know, on the panel, who's like, I mean, he's beyond a Blairite. I don't know what you'd even describe this guy as. He's like neoliberalism on steroids. You know, he's like walking, talking epitome of a neoliberal, you know, pro-Iraq war, you know, kind of pro-austerity, weird. But then it says, no, but you can't call me a Tory. And it's like, pro-war, pro-dismantling the welfare state. I think there's a case. This whole Fabian thing, basically. What's his face? James Schneider from Momentum was on the panel as well. Yeah. So he kind of had the enemy in their midst. And they were absolutely pillorying James and the whole kind of Momentum movement and Corbyn supporters. It was like a parent talking to a child, you know, kind of really dismissively of just like, look, you know, we knock on doors, we know what people think. And, you know, kind of, I actually made the point in the room of just like, this is the issue. It's like the only time you speak to members of the public is when you're knocking doors, you know, and it, like, you know, James Snyder doesn't need to knock on doors to know what people think because he's down the pub, you know. It's like, I don't think they totally underestimated, completely, like they totally underestimated not only actually the ability of Momentum to organize, I mean, they seriously underestimated the brains behind Momentum and actually the skill of the activists that join them, but they also kind of underestimated the number of interactions a Corbyn supporter will have with voters just on a daily basis. You know, if you're a person who, you know, adamantly supports Corbyn and Momentum and you're actually ideologically in support of that, you're really pro it, not because you're being paid, just because that's your view, you're going to be talking to people in the office, you're going to be talking to people in the queue at the chippy. It's like all of these potential points. And actually, most people I know do not choose who to vote for based solely on who knocks on their door come election time. There are lots of other factors. And actually,
100%. This is why, like, Corbyn's platform was one of the only things that I thought throughout, nice to have been proved right, but for since it began, like, I thought that the Corbyn platform was the only thing that can invigorate such a wide grassroots movement that you can't really measure.
Yeah.
It's hard to measure, but it's just happening everywhere. For example, like MIA, the artist, I don't think she's ever made a political video before. She was like, did a little video of her in her car saying, like, you should really vote for Corbyn on election day. That's just one small example of, like, all these other people who've got small platforms or medium-sized platforms who are all saying, look, this is what we need to do right now. And that would never happen if you had Owen Smith up there or someone else who people wouldn't want to offer their guidance to tell people to vote for, because they wouldn't know whether or not they could trust what they were going to do and all this kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
So it's only really Corbyn's conviction with his platform combined that could invigorate such a wide grassroots explosion of politics and engagement.
Absolutely. I don't think we're going to see a grime for Theresa May hashtag anytime.
there's photos of her at some festival with some photo op after the whole Corbyn Glastonbury thing, which was quite amusing.
Oh, it was brilliant. I absolutely loved that. It was like Theresa May and 10 placards held by Tory activists, you know, versus Corbyn at Glastonbury.
And, drawing, you know, bigger crowds than like the main acts.
So. Absolutely. I mean, that's what staggered me is, you know, that could have totally backfired. You know, people could have easily just sort of turned their backs, walked away, booed. Like, there was so much that could have
gone wrong with that. It was like a high stakes, you know, situation. Yeah.
No, awesome. People, the Glastonbury crowd was, I'm sure there are a lot of Tories there like grinding their teeth in the crowd.
So talking of Tories grinding their teeth, if we bring it back to the issue at hand, this campaign unseat of eight of the worst Tories that are, you know, in the cabinet or have been in the cabinet. What can people do, James, to actually get involved and support the Unseat the Tories campaign?
Well, you can visit the Unseat website and contact people there and ask what you can do to help. You can find out when these campaign rallies are, which I'm sure will be posted by Momentum. If you live in the areas, you can go and get involved as soon as possible. And if you live, especially if you live in nearby constituencies, you can come and focus your attention on seats that are totally winnable now, i.e. these eight seats. You could also jump on board with Momentum in a digital way. Then you can ask Momentum for training and try to make some viral content specifically to get rid of these MPs, short videos about, you know, what they've said and why it's just a national disgrace that they're representing us in government.
Superb. So short version, if you're in the constituencies, you can literally do this. You can get involved with actually getting rid of the eight yourself personally and directly, but you don't even have to be in the constituencies to do that. So if you're outside of the constituencies, you could make sure that you're sharing the content on your social media feed, be talking about it with your friends and your families or at your university or, you know, wherever you are, whatever groups that you're interacting with, be talking about it.
That's one of the main things, I think, just not being like, not sort of internalizing that myth that people don't care about politics and they don't want to talk about it. They might seem a bit edgy at first, but if you persevere and keep talking and just make it relevant to them, because everything is politics. When, you know, if you're a young person as well, you know that all of your friends are just spending like, I don't know, up to like half their income on rent, which is just taking all of that out of the economy, out of the consumer wider spending power, and putting that into the hands of a few landlords, which is just terrible for the economy.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's a tangent. it's about making the sometimes ideas like social housing that seem kind of abstract, making them completely concrete to that person's life, i.e. rent, i.e. welfare, and all of these issues that completely affect people every day and restrict their freedom in massive ways and restrict them being able to be the people that they could be for themselves and also for the rest of us. So yeah, it's about those conversations as well. And yeah, in general, as well as getting involved with the more kind of
hands-on stuff. Brilliant. Thank you so much for that, James. And if you are interested in doing something and getting involved in that campaign in any way that you possibly can, the details are going to be in the notes under the podcast. So get in there, get involved, find a way of doing this. Because as we say, you know, you'll be listening today and everything we're talking about is not just a systemic issue and a political issue. These are personal issues. These are lives that are impacted, lives that are limited, lives that are devastated, or lives that are extinguished because of the decisions that are being made by these politicians. It's only fair that we put better politicians in place to make better decisions. Okay, we'll wrap up there then, James, because we're running out of time. And just to thank everyone for coming onto the call today, Beck Sumner, Steve Topple, and wrapping up with James. So that's us done for another week at Canary Pod. Please make sure you follow us at Canary Pod on Twitter and use the hashtag Canary Pod to carry on the discussion. We'll see you next week. Until then, remember, don't get angry, get involved.